Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, being done completely without video, because despite the fact that you pay for Skype group frickin' video, you can't do group frickin' video, which means I'm going to have to ask for my money back from those scum. I mean, look at it this way. Bill Gates doesn't need my money. Why would he take it without offering me a service in exchange? That's frickin' annoying. Anyway, today, ladies and gentlemen, I might be a bit sleep-deprived and have a bit of a short fuse, as you might have told already, might be able to tell already. And my very special guests are Stu Webb and CIA whistleblower Chip Tatum. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Good to be here.
Thank you, Vinny, for having us again.
It's about as close to a mind control program as you can get on talk radio. So, we would like to get a wee bit of an introduction and background on the both of you for those who don't know. So, Stu, let's quickly start with you. Just tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do.
Well, I'm a federal whistleblower, been one since 1988. Caused four congressional investigations back-to-back, the HUD scandal of 1989, the Silverado scandal, the Denver International Airport scandal, and what they called the Keating 5/MDC 200. Yeah, Colorado State's biggest case, but it ended up the Keating 5. But those were all congressional investigations. Since then, I've been after Crime Syndicate, which is my ex-in-law that controls AIPAC, which is Daddy Bush's partner. I think that says it all.
Are they AIPAC of liars?
Pardon me?
AIPAC of liars? Is that why they call it AIPAC?
Yeah, AIPAC of liars, you're right. AIPAC, the Israeli Mossad that overthrew America, American-Israeli pact.
You know, there's a reason why they call them Mossad, because they ain't there to make you more happy.
No, they aren't. They aren't. They don't make anybody happy. But I married the daughter of an Illuminati 12, Daddy Bush's, and Meyer Rothschild, and Henry Kissinger, and David Rockefeller, and Anwar bin Sharia of Israel, and all the 12 of them. I married the daughter of one of them. They took my kid from me illegally, and after she tried to murder our daughter, and here I am 30 years later, and with lifetime restraining orders out of an illegal second court where they said they paid me off and to go away, sealed for life, can't open the case until I get some justice. There's no justice in America. So here I am still today out here yelling and screaming, exposing them, and probably will be until the day I die.
That's why they call it the criminal justice system, because they're just criminals.
That's all they are.
Yeah. Okay, Chip Tatum, your story, background, please.
I have a little history. 20 years working for the United States government. I started my government service in the Air Force as a in special operations as a combat controller. Served in Vietnam. Served in Grenada, served in Cambodia, served as a special ops pilot in the 160th Aviation. A lot of people, you might know those. That group is the guys that flew in to get Osama bin Laden with the broken helicopter. I was a pilot with that group. And in later years, after 1986, I worked for the operational subgroups, which were directed by National Reconnaissance Office and the Vice President of the United States.
Anything further on top of that?
No, nothing more than that.
It's just your service, and then that's it. You know, are you still a member of the government? You know.
Oh no, they don't have enough money for me to work for them. once they charged me with treason, that was enough.
Okay. Well, what happens to you when you get charged with treason? How are you still here?
Well, I'll tell you what happens to you. They throw you in a deep, dark cell and forget you're there. I was on underground in Florence, Colorado, in Supermax, put on diesel therapy where I wasn't. When they traveled me around the United States, media was trying to get a hold of me. I wasn't in the same place for more than a day so that I couldn't get on telephones to advise anyone where I was. The U.S. Marshals would pick me up at 4 in the morning, drop me off at 11 at night, going from city to city to city jail for 6 months.
I think that's one of the part of the mind control programs, I think, is they try to disorient and to destroy you, keep you away from family, contacts, things of that nature, so that you feel completely alone and that you've got no hope kind of thing. Is that what they were doing to you?
Yeah, trying to break you. Uh-huh. It's the MO for that. They couldn't do it. Taking me from jail to jail was like having chauffeurs and having room service when I was in solitary. So,
and why did they charge you with treason exactly? What did you do?
I had in earlier years working for the government, doing the nefarious deeds that we were doing, flying drugs, doing assassinations. I had collected a lot of information to protect myself, and having seen what happened to others. And when I walked away from the OSGs in 1992, the day I walked away is the day they asked us to neutralize Ross Perot, get him out of the election. And that's just not the way we do business. But that's the way Bush wanted it done. And so I walked away and I told him I had my insurance policy. I gave him a copy of what I'd collected through the years. And I put those copies in 8 places around the world. In the event of my death, they were to be brought out to the media. They told me to give them all those copies or I'd be charged with treason and placed in jail, probably put to death. I said, let's dance. I didn't think they could do it, but I'll be darned, they sure did.
Yeah, it's not exactly a pleasant experience to know that the people you've been working for all this time just suddenly turn on you, is it?
Well, but you see it. You know, I had predecessors. They did the same. We had people we'd fly that worked with them, people, you know, the Iran-Contra leaders that crossed them. It was our job to go in and take them out. We did. Other leaders around the world that crossed Reagan and Bush, it was our job to take them out, and we did. So we knew they would have no qualms about coming against one of us. We're just a throwaway. Just
a loose end.
Right.
Well, could you then divulge? Who were you assassinating?
Well, we assassinated one of the Iran-Contra leaders, a man named Enrique Bermudez. He was in 1990, Nicaragua, decided to hold free elections. They had elections, and a woman named Chamorro came in as the new president. He wanted a high position. She thought he was too gruff to work in her administration, and he threatened the administration that if he didn't get placed in a high position, he'd turn over all the information, all of the drugs that they were making in their Contra camps in Nicaragua and sending to the U.S. They couldn't have that, so he was taken down. Walking outside of the Intercontinental Hotel in 1991, he was shot.
Now, what's interesting is that just last night, not 8 hours ago, I just got off doing a 3-hour interview with Ole Damegaard, who was telling me about the template by which the New World Order has teams of assassins to go in. How many people were in your team, and how many teams were there at the time? He said that they were usually between 3 and 4 teams of 3 that would come in, and they would be the assassins that would come in about maybe a couple of weeks to a month after the initial surveillance teams would come in, identify the target, get all their habits down, and then set up a shooting position, that kind of thing.
If shooting was the mode, yes. We had four OSG teams, operational subgroups that worked under the Terrorist Incident Working Group from the National Security Council. We received our orders directly from the White House. The size of the teams would vary, to be honest, depending upon the mission. If it was a straight assassination, we wouldn't go in heavy. If it was an intimidation or neutralization or blackmail, we've flown computer geniuses around the world. They've gone in, they've hacked banks, taken money from congressmen in foreign nations or parliament in foreign nations, moved money out to neutralize them, get them to vote the way that they want or get them to do what they wanted to. So just depended on the mission. But normally no more than about, I'd say the heaviest mission we had was 6 people.
Yeah. But probably like average of three, one shooter, one driver, one spotter.
And one to take care of business if they failed.
A cleanup guy kind of thing.
Exactly.
And how long had you been doing this? You said you've been working for the U.S. government for a good 20 years.
Sure. I started in 1970 as a young military man. Then I was recruited across and sheep-dipped and placed in with the Defense Intelligence Agency, worked for them, worked for the CIA, worked for the, as I said, National Security Council, worked for Ollie North. He was my boss.
Really? Was yes, Ollie sir. A nice guy in person? And did he give you any of his gold?
Ollie was a dipshit. You know, here's a guy, Mr. Blood and Guts from Vietnam. Now, he was heavily awarded and everything, but he lost it over the years. We went into one Contra camp, and there was a lot of blood flowing, and we'd flown in a medevac helicopter from Honduras into Nicaragua. There was a lot of blood flowing, and he got weak knees and fell out on us. So Mr. Blood and Guts, the brave Marine colonel, got a little too money hungry.
Well, how much did he make away with, do you reckon?
Oh, I'd say over $100 million. I know during his Senate campaign, back in those days, the reward is that they'll run you for a congressional seat, a Senate seat. And in his campaign, anything he didn't spend, he got to keep. And the PACs boosted him with millions and millions of dollars that he only spent like $1.5 million on his campaign and got to keep everything else. Didn't have any intention of winning.
All you do is convert it to personal income when you're a candidate and declare a tax on it.
Right. And then there's the Enterprise. Look, the Enterprise sold drugs, they sold arms, they sold aircraft, they sold uranium, they sold everything. I know the deal with uranium was over $1 billion with the Iranians, selling illegal uranium to them out of a South African mine that the British owned. So he got a piece of it, there's no doubt. He was right up there in the cabal, right on top.
We can't forget, Vinny. Is our current ongoing Pier 66 Miami drug operation involving his submarine company that brings cocaine in from Colombia and different places in Central America, packed in ice, and lands at Jeb Bush's operation there at Pier 66 with Jeb Bush and, I might add, Roger Moore, the gun shop owner and the Oklahoma City bombing. He's got his three yachts coming in there weekly full of cocaine and other drugs. That's the Texaco refinery, by the way, on Pier 66.
Okay. Well, what is it that you guys would like to really... what's the direction you guys would like to take this conversation today? Because really, you can take it anywhere.
Well, why don't we let Chip do most of the conversation here, because he is not that known. He did a lot of radio shows with me. As a co-guest, we did them together. I kind of introduced him into the Patriot world, as I'm doing now. And then after that, he did hundreds of shows. If you remember the cocaine trafficking in the United States back in the 1990s, mid-90s.
And, you mean Whitewater or Clinton's kind of involvement?
Well, he was involved there, too. And I think it's good to question him here. And I'll kind of co-host with you as far as a few questions, because I know Gene well, but back in the mid-90s, Maxine Waters, Congressman Maxine Waters of California, we got her riled all up about the illegal Bush cocaine coming in, CIA trafficking in the U.S., and Gary Webb was writing a series of stories in the Jose Mercury Press, which ended up later wrote his book. So Gene,
whose bloody phone is that?
Gene was his source on that, and it later got Gary Webb murdered when he came out with his book, Suicide, you know, on the type deals. But, Gene, you want to start with maybe your Vietnam experience and tell us about Mr. Rambo, Gene Chip Tatum in Cambodia? Maybe start there.
He doesn't even appear to be there at the moment. Oh,
that's right at the beginning.
There's another thing. We have 3 hours. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, and we're only 15 minutes into the interview thus far. So don't leave out any details by any means.
Okay, I was we'll start right at the beginning. I was recruited, actually not recruited, in 1970. The United States had a thing called the draft. And if you were in a religious, you could get, let me see, what was there? There was physical disabilities, you would stay out of the draft. For religious reasons, you could stay out of the draft. And for a university, you could stay out of the draft. I was in university at the time, but I made an F on one of my classes in chemistry. I forgot to go to the lab classes. Did fine, made an A in my classroom, but didn't go to any lab classes. I didn't even know they existed. And so the draft board got the notice that I had flunked out on a chemistry exam, and I got a notice in the mail. We want you to come report. So I reported to the draft office. And there sitting were all the recruiters for the United States military. There was the Air Force, there was Army, there was Marines, there was Navy. And I went to each one of them. And the Marines, I knew I didn't want to go with them. They were just kind of nuts. The Army, I knew if I went to the Army, they'd be going to Vietnam. The Navy didn't look bad now. They had the bell-bottom jeans and the Cambry shirts, if you remember those days in the 70s. But going out on ships all the time, I didn't care for that idea. When I saw the Air Force recruiter, he said, look, even if you do go to Vietnam, what we'll do for you is we're going to make you an air traffic controller. So you'll be 100 miles away from any of the enemy lines, sitting in an air-conditioned air traffic control tower, controlling all these aircraft coming in and out. And when you get out, you'll have a good job. I bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. So I went to Keesler Air Force Base January 1970, graduated in the top of the class, 12 weeks later. And, next thing I knew, the top 10% of the class was sent to jump school in Georgia. We went to jump school. We went from, jump school to C survival school to escape and evasion, and after that, we went to diving school, and then the next thing I know, I was shipped off to Southeast Asia. We were in a brand new career field called the combat controllers. Now, if you can imagine, you've seen the movies. The enemies in one area, the friendly militaries in the other area, and to make sure that the jets coming in at 600-800 miles an hour don't drop on the wrong people. They dropped us with parachutes in between the two to call in the airstrikes. That's the combat controller. Additionally, we worked as forward air controllers when not jumping and going up in aircraft, calling in the airstrikes on the enemy, and in a slow prop job, just floating up there, getting ready, waiting to get shot. We could take on small arms fire or anti-aircraft rounds up there. We weren't that high. While I was in Thailand, I was stationed in Thailand in support of a group called Task Force Alpha. Task Force Alpha was the supporting entity for a civilian group working in Cambodia and Laos called Air America. When those aircraft would go down, we would have the job of jumping in, picking up the crypto gear on board the aircraft. Any pilots left alive or crew members left alive, we'd extract them, and then any cargo, any valuable cargo they might have on board, we'd extract that. I'm going to tell you, folks, Air America flew a lot of rice, and that rice was in bricks, in those big sacks, and we extracted a lot of those bricks of rice out of both Cambodia and Laos. While I was there, there was a special operations team being put together that I didn't know about. Apparently, Nixon administration had decided that to get out of the war, they needed to get the Cambodians involved with the South Vietnamese. That was the only way that the Americans could leave and South Vietnam to have a chance against the North Vietnamese. Unfortunately, Lon Nol, the premier of Cambodia, was a fence setter. He was getting money from the U.S. and arms from the U.S. he was also getting money in arms from China. The money in arms from China he was using to help, he was getting to help support the Viet Cong in his, that would come up and hide and arm themselves and train in his country. And the money from the United States he would use to fight with a group of rebels within his country against his government called the Khmer Rouge. So he was very happy getting all that money, all those arms from both sides, without having to make a move one way or another. It was decided that what had to happen is the North Vietnamese had to make a move on him and cause him to want more support from the United States. Well, it just wasn't happening. They were very happy with what was going on. So Washington decided to put a false flag up. They decided to put a special forces unit together, go in, blow up the Phnom Penh airport, leaving bodies of Viet Cong around, and sneak out. There was a 14-man contingency put together, training just for that mission. And unfortunately, the Camo guy of the special forces unit had broken his leg in one of the practice jumps. And I was one of the in the area of operations, one of the people that had experience with square canopy jumps instead of round canopies. So I was pulled in, and we jumped in. We pulled off the mission. We dropped the sappers, North Vietnamese sappers. We killed them, left them in various points around the airport. Got to our extraction point after a day, and no one ever came. So we sat there and we waited, and we got on the radios and we called, and no one answered. Come to find out, Nixon ordered that there's no way that we were to be picked up. No one could ever know that the United States went in and pulled off that mission against our allies. What it did, it was very successful. Within days, the United States was called by the Lon Nol administration and asked to come in. We already had ships and aircraft offshore waiting to go in. Within days, they had mounted a full regiment in Cambodia, and they had Marines, they had Air Force, Army, they had the works in there. We were subsequently captured. There were only 13 of us because one had been shot. We were subsequently captured, we were in the encampment a couple of weeks, being tortured, being questioned. Why were we dressed in Viet Cong clothes when you're obviously not Viet Cong? What are you doing here? Where did you come from? Who are you? We wouldn't answer. Not one word came out of our mouths. I did happen to know some Spanish words, so I spoke to him in Spanish. But that's the only thing that any of us ever said. We were lucky. Marine Recon Patrol, who had been brought in after the request of Lon Nol to help clean up the area because we weren't that far outside of Phnom Penh. This patrol happened to walk up on the encampment where we were held. They got in a firefight with our captors. They won, and those of us that were left alive were able to come out alive. I was wounded. My first sergeant was wounded. I'd been extracted to a hospital in the Philippines in Clark Air Force Base. But we were the only two that left alive. I was in a coma for 2 weeks. When I came out of my coma a couple days later, the man who called and briefed the mission, a man by the name of Colby, who later became the Director of Central Intelligence, told me that Washington had decided that they needed to keep me close to make sure that I didn't talk about this. He expressed to me the need for silence on the whole thing. And I didn't have a problem with that. So he said, now you have a choice. You can come. We'd like you to come across to the CIA. But if you really want to, you can stay with the Air Force, but you'll be under control of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So, I didn't want to go back to I didn't even want to go to the CIA. Those guys, they're the ones who caused us the problem to begin with. So I accepted to continue in the Air Force and work under control of the Defense Intelligence Agency. From that time until 1978, when I decided to leave the service, I was under their control and did various missions around the world. Italy, Yugoslavia, Argentina, Bolivia. In 1978, Ambassador Colby was leaving. He was DCI Colby at the time. He was leaving, and he contacted me and said, "Son, you need to think about getting out because I can't be around to protect you any longer." I said, "All right, you're on." I got out, went to the mountains of Colorado to live because there's great skiing and hunting up there. And I wasn't out 6 months before some men in their sunglasses and black jackets came in, explained to me that I was being reactivated into the United States Army this time. They sent me to Fort Rucker, Alabama. We went to a special flight training, and from there to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where we picked up and started flying for the 160th. I was attached to as a little bird pilot. A little bird is the, if you guys know, it's the old Hughes 500, the one that Magnum PI flew around in, except these were very, very heavily armed. And that's in a nutshell, up through 1983, what I did.
And could you tell us how you got out of this and precisely the story that exactly happened to you, like in painstaking detail, preferably?
Yeah, I imagine.
Well, and also I understand that going back through memories like this, going through past traumas and things like that, a lot of these emotions and things will come up, and I'm sensitive to that. So, you know,
sure.
whatever you feel.
The VA was nice. They gave me Xanax and Valium, and, you know, they gave me everything I need. Well, 160th Aviation in Fort Campbell, Kentucky was being formed. I was there in 1980. They took what they'd done is to form the unit. They took a lot of old special forces experienced in combat from Vietnam, and they placed them in the aviation company, taught them to fly because they didn't want them flying in the restrictive capacity that normal aviators are taught. For the Army and for the Air Force and Navy. So they put us in this special unit, trained us specially to not be confined by existing safety regulations. We flew primarily with night vision goggles, day goggles and night goggles. We'd practice every time we flew as often as we could. We would be flying with night vision goggles, thus the name the Night Stalkers. When you're in a helicopter, you're low and you're slow. And the only thing you have is the element of surprise because you're vulnerable to small arms fire. You're vulnerable to people throwing rocks at you. We would fly so low. So, we worked and trained and worked and trained, flying in around the United States. We'd practice, flying Delta Force operatives. We practiced flying, special ops guys. All over the United States, we do practices into cities, into major cities, wearing filters going in. We'd attack casinos. We'd drop them to the top of the casinos. They'd rappel down into the top of the casino, just for practice for the anti-terror training. And
you were the guys, Gene, that was buzzing my house probably on many times, or at least that squad, right?
If you were in Denver, I was. Sure, we around the United States in all environments. We did a lot in Colorado because it was such a high altitude, and the lighter the air with these helicopters, the more difficult things were. So we trained for that. Finally, we decided, look, this is, you know, we can train, but the one thing we can't do is get a practical application of this. So the opportunity came off of a little island in the Caribbean, when some Cuban military decided to go into the island and start building a small Cuban base there. The name of the island was Grenada. Grenada was a perfect platform for us, a perfect entity for us to test our new arms platforms, our new armament, our flight techniques, and everything we had as a 160th. So Ollie North, who was in the National Reconnaissance Office, got authorization, General Schwarzkopf was to run the operation, and we took off on ships, went down to the small island Grenada, and for 2 days we raided that small island. We did, however, save some, not that they needed save, we saved some medical students who were there. That was the Grenada invasion, in case anyone ever wondered why we really went there. We went there to test those platforms. It was basically training, what we call real fire training. After Grenada, I was sent to Fort Stewart, Georgia. In the early 80s, the United States government, the CIA, decided to start a campaign of war against a regime in Nicaragua called the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas had won by popular vote, came in, but because they were a group that may start nationalizing properties and taking properties away from the banana growers, American banana growers, and the American oil industry, they decided it would not be in America's best interest and national security's best interest for that to happen to our corporations. So they started training a group of the Somozans, which were a pretty rowdy and pretty cruel bunch of military forces who had been outed by the Sandinistas. They would routinely, they had death squads, they would go in, they would rape and pillage in the villages of Nicaragua. That's what got them voted out, what was the whole Somozan regime. But these ended up being the people that the CIA recruited to build this new army to go up against the Sandinistas called the Contras. They promised them if they would come into the Contra camps, they would pay them daily. They could bring their families in. They would have food. They would have protection. They would have money. They would have all the arms they would need, and they would have all the training. And they did that. They did that for several years until Congress found out about it. We were mining some harbors in Bluefields, Nicaragua, using NOAA ships and Navy SEALs. And one of the SEALs got his hand blown off, and we had to take him out, extract him, and fly him to some hospital ships. When they found out about that, they enacted the Boland Act, which only allowed U.S. assistance in the form of humanitarian assistance to the Nicaraguans. That included food and medical. So they decided this is what we're going to do. They took two special ops crews, sent them to Fort Stewart, Georgia. They sent us to Fort Stewart because Fort Stewart was coming up on the list of aviation companies that were going through rotation and going over to Honduras for a year. So we got into Fort Stewart as medevac pilots. We were sent in, I believe, January. We were sent January of 84. We were sent to Honduras. I was under the control of three entities. I flew for the United States Army, medevac, under control of the hospital commander in the local aviation unit. I flew for the Enterprise, and I flew for the third entity that we flew for. It was called Pegasus Group. And we could be called on missions by any one of those three groups. We had a man, major in Honduras, from military intelligence, that his name was Major Rodriguez. People may have heard of him. His real name is Felix Rodriguez. He was working for the CIA and one of their best fighters for many years, including against the Cubans. In Honduras, the missions called by North, by the National Reconnaissance Office, would often take us into flying medevac helicopters. We would be flying arms and arms, munitions, and intelligence personnel into the Contra camps, into the Nicaraguan, what we call the buffer zone, dropping those off. And invariably, they would fill us up with coolers, at least 10 coolers. These are these big, big coolers, like 110-quart coolers, if you've all ever seen them. Big white coolers, blue coolers, whatever. And those coolers, and we never really looked at them because they were coming out. We were just dropping them off to aircraft in San Pedro Sula and in San Lorenzo. one on San Pedro on the Caribbean side with military aircraft bound for Panama. San Lorenzo on the Pacific side was all civilian aircraft. Barry Seal was one of the pilots that would invariably pick those up. One day we had a hard landing, and one of the coolers fell out the open door and busted open, and there we saw all these bricks of cocaine. So we knew then what we were doing. I called North, and I said, "Do you know what's in these coolers?" He said, "Yeah, I know what's in those coolers." I said, "Well, what the hell are we doing here?" He said, "Well, don't worry about it, Tatum. It's all evidence for the world courts. It's the fruits of war that we got from the Sandinistas, from the Nicaraguans." I said, "There's no way that every week we fly in there and get new coolers from the Sandinistas." He said, "I told you not to worry about it." I said, "All right." And from that day forward, every flight plan that I flew on, we marked on that flight plan exactly what we had on board. We counted the coolers. We named the names of the people. We recorded everything that was said in the back of the aircraft and kept those. Now, I had published in what's called the Tatum Chronicles. That's on my website, chiptatum.com, chiptatum.com. Go to downloads. You can download copies of those official United States Army flight plans. And on the front and on the back, signed by all the crew members, are pretty amazing statements from the time. I had gone back and gotten those a couple years later from the Honduran military running the base where we were flying out of. They maintained copies of our flight plans. Where am I? In 1986, it was time for me to leave. They caught on to us making these illegal flights, and so the Army said, "You guys are out of there. You can't keep making these illegal flights." So the people I worked for pulled me out of the military, put me in civilian service, running what we call proprietary companies. They gave me a proprietary construction company up in New York, upstate New York, gave us a $250,000 line of credit. We never built anything, by the way. Gave us a $250,000 line of credit, and our job was to go fly. We had missions going around the world, and we based out of Syracuse, New York. We'd fly fixed-wing aircraft. We'd fly rotary-wing aircraft. Many times we'd be moving people under radar across the Canadian border back and forth, people and money. On some occasions we'd fly, we moved money for a general in Indonesia. He had $26 million he needed to get out. I guess that was his blood money. We ended up flying that into Costa Rica and hiding it in some Costa Rican banks for him. We've flown missions for the Prince of Brunei. We've flown a lot of missions for the Israelis, One in particular, there was an Israeli officer went by the AKA Pat Weber, whose name was really Amiram Nir. And he was on a flight in Mexico, and they decided that he was a little getting a little too loose on things and didn't feel that he was it was safe for them to allow him. He had just been petitioned to come, summoned to come to the United States to testify in some Iran-Contra hearings against General Secord, Sinlab, and North, and President Reagan, Vice President Bush, against Poindexter, against all of them. And they decided that he couldn't do that. So we were given the mission, not knowing who it was or what it was all about, to take this aircraft down. And in our MD-500, we based out of Tegucigalpa, Honduras, we flew down and we took his aircraft down, and he was killed. That takes me through about about 1990, and working directly for the operational subgroups. We would, as I said, routinely fly to foreign countries. On one occasion, I can give you a little bit of information. We flew to France. There was a French politician that they needed to turn him on some kind of a vote. We flew a nerd team in. they hacked into the politician's bank account, stole all the money out of it. An operative was sent in and told him that if he didn't do what they needed him to do, he'd never see that money again. I guess they did it because we flew back in about 3 weeks later and fixed the accounts for him. In 1992, in a meeting in, let me backtrack. While I was at Fort Campbell, I know Stu wants me to talk about this, and I'm going to let him talk about what he knows about it. In 1982, I was at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. We would routinely, those coolers I was talking about, we weren't the only medevac pilots doing that. We had a medevac out of Fort Campbell that got the call too, and those were special ops pilots, and they would bring coolers back. They would put on C-130s and bring them back. On one particular occasion, flying cross country, we were given a cooler and told to drop it off at the Little Rock Air Force Base. We flew that little small cooler to Little Rock Air Force Base. It said medical supplies. I didn't believe it, so I opened it. It had about 10 kilos of cocaine and a whole bunch of money stacks sitting in it. We flew it into Little Rock Air Force Base. We were met by a limo owned by Jackson Stevens. Mr. Stevens got out of the limo, identified himself, introduced us to the then governor of the state, William Clinton. Stu, you got something there?
Yeah, well, how about Bill Clinton's brother? What did he say? The DEA's got him on tape saying?
One particular friend of mine from the DEA told me that in one particular, Jackson, let me qualify this. Jackson Stevens was an international banker. He also had huge parties in his home, in his mansion there in Little Rock. I mean, he's known for the parties. His chauffeur was named Roger Clinton. Now, Roger was Bill Clinton's brother. It was Roger's job to go out and make sure that all the party favors were there. And so he'd go out and his job was to go out, get the dope, get the weed, get the powder, get everything. He was talking to one of his suppliers and, he told the supplier, listen, I know I ordered this much, but, I'm going to need a little more because my brother's coming to the party and he's got a nose like a vacuum cleaner. Speaking of, our esteemed President Clinton, but then governor.
I throw a few things in there, Benny, that over the years I've also heard and investigated and got from a lot of shadow types like Gene. I've only known about 10 or 12 of them. But I've known tons of
them. Gene, you might want to stop typing, or if you are going to type, press mute, because we can hear that. Okay, sorry. Stu, continue. Anyway,
yeah, Jackson Stevens was all directly hooked up with Leonard Melman and Larry Mizell and Hillary Clinton. And that all encompassed what was called BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which the La Rock law firm came and saw me and others when they put Charles Keating in jail. That's what actually put him in jail, was a private RICO suit because the government refused to do their job. They were covering it all up. And it encompassed the Saudi royal family, members of the Bush family. It encompassed Larry Mizell and MDC, which settled in the case fraudulently, claiming they were in bankruptcy when he filed a fraudulent frauds upon the court filing. It was on a land track subsidiary company to try to get by with saying to keep from paying hundreds of millions that they stole in billions. But that was what put Charles Keating in jail. But what was interesting, just about a year before that, the Securities and Exchange Commission came after Jackson Stevens. And when he came out after Jackson Stevens, guess who the attorney of record was? Hillary Witch Clinton. So it's just an endless, interesting tidbit.
Oh, you just can't make this stuff up, Stu.
I have the documents to prove it.
That's actually one of my favorite phrases. You know, like whenever Alex Jones says it, I just crack up laughing. I have the documents. And he's damaged me for life. I can't, like, nobody can say to me, I have the documents, without me going a little bit, you know? I don't know what it is about people having documents. It's just funny to me.
Let me see if I can find the one on the computer and drop it into you in the chat room between us here, right? Gene continues his story. Now, Gene, you were heavily involved in Colorado at one time, too, in some loan stuff, weren't you? Chip, you still there?
You might be on mute.
Yes, when I was stationed in Italy and doing work in the mid-70s in Yugoslavia, following that tour, I was sent to the high plains of Colorado to a place called Operation OLAB, a top secret AT&T site that wasn't really an AT&T site on the high plains of Colorado, out in the middle of nowhere. The closest town had about 15,000 people in it. And we were based out of Colorado Springs and out of NORAD, Cheyenne Mountain was our home base. So every week, we would have to take a trip for administrative purposes, drive into Colorado Springs, or many times because Buckley Field had a lot of communications entities, and that's what we were. We would have to go drop off tapes and that we had recorded from the communications from our sending communications into space, and what we'd receive back, we'd take those tapes to Buckley and drop those off. But every time we went to Denver, we would be charged with stopping at a little savings and loan, picking up several boxes of documents and dropping those off at an attorney's office in Denver by the name of Brownstein in Denver. One time I decided just to see what the heck was in these documents and in these boxes. And it was nothing, just houses, just, you know, loan documents and titles to lands and things like that. So I didn't think anything of it until years later when I met Stu, and Stu said, you know, you ever find out what they were doing with those 70,000 homes that were stolen from HUD? And I got to thinking about it. I said, oh my God, I know where they went. And that's exactly where they went. They were going into this guy named Brownstein, and Stu can tell you who Brownstein is.
Brownstein was my former father-in-law's attorney, and he was Daddy Bush's attorney, who was one of the six CIA counsel when George Herbert Walker Bush was CIA director in the 1970s. And he was on the board of directors of Silverado Savings and MDC Holdings, that was the parent company for Silverado, where Neil Bush was. It was the CIA bank. And I do have those documents. I'm going to drop to you right here. Why we let Gene continue. He's come across a lot of things, but I'm going to drop the document on this BCCI showing Hillary Clinton. And that way you'll have one for yourself, Benny. How's that sound?
Well, you know, I'm not much of a document reader. I leave that to the serious researchers. I'm just a douchebag interviewer with a microphone, bro.
I worked with Jonathan Beatty of Time Magazine that broke out about the Denver airport, because I couldn't get the Denver Post or the Rocky Mountain News to break the story about their illegal political campaign money laundering.
Yeah.
I'd put the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News before it was bought out by the crowd that owned the Houston Post, Dean Singleton that owns Associated Press. That's all controlled by Mizell in Denver. And before that, they had probably done about 50 stories for me, the two different newspapers. And I was working the press back then when I was behind the scenes in that 89 to 91 time frame. And, of course, then I got the infamous trip like Chip does, and charged with terroristic death threats that never occurred. And then later the charges were dismissed after being held for 10 and a half months. And I came across people that were in the lower level than what Chip was. It was probably a lot of the people he was extracting out of camps down there in Nicaragua, and different stuff were all in there, where Daddy had all these Iran-Contra boys locked up. There were 1,500 of them locked up in Springfield, Missouri, where they were all being mentally evaluated, trying to say they were nuts, making up this stuff. They tried to do it to me. It didn't work. Shrink said there wasn't anything wrong with me. And they even said they couldn't understand why I'd even been sent there, that there was no evidence to send me there, that it was a newspaper article that was written in Westward newspaper where they had tried to slander me after I'd been arrested. And the whole bit, and that's because I caused those scandals. But I worked with Beatty, and Beatty spun out of there while I'm hiding from the FBI between 91 and 92. They wanted to kill me, Daddy Bush, and got arrested in September of 92. But during that period of time, I was working with Jonathan Beatty. Well, he got his contract, $1 million book deal with Time Magazine, you do the book called The Outlaw Bank, BCCI, Bank of Credit and Commerce International. That's where a lot of the savings and loan money got laundered through, folks. That's where a lot of your money was stolen and laundered through. Charles Keating and all that European investment group, which included the Saudis, the UAE, you name it, they were all pumping the money through there, right out of America. And it was going through a Swiss Bank Corp in Switzerland and Bank of Credit, Commerce International, et cetera. But I'm going to drop you the document on Hillary, where you can see this. And Gene, you might want to load down on too. But anyway, why don't you continue on this?
Because might I interject here? While we were talking, I recall we tried to do this interview in video, and there was some kind of technical issue. While we were talking, I actually looked up on Skype, and it turns out that we might have the older versions of Skype. So I was thinking we should take a quick 5-minute break, upgrade our Skypes, and then come back for the second and third hours in video. How's that sound?
Well, that sounds okay with me. I'm upgraded already as of a few days ago, but... why don't we try it? Unless they got a new version since then.
Oh, well, it's. I think it might just be me, so. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you after the break. And, of course, the videos, bear in mind, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show are uploaded to the YouTube channel, Mr. News, Guerrilla Media. Other than that, you know, the audio is just fine, isn't it? You know, it gives you a little bit of something to the imagination. Plus, I'm not that pretty, and I'm just getting worse. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.